Blog Talk Radio.
Live from the Golden State. Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be, on the internet and around the world. Welcome to another edition of Radio Pangea. I'm your host, Lauren Cartagena. And on today's news program, we're going to be talking about some diverse topics from around the United States and the world. But starting off with our first story, comes from the U.S., and Christmas time is upon us. So here is an interesting Christmas story, a real event that just happened. A U.S. man dressed up as Santa Claus fulfilled a dying boy's Christmas dream by visiting him at his bedside before the youngster passed away in his arms. Get this. Eric Schmidt-Motson rushed to a local hospital in Tennessee after receiving a call about a terminally ill 5-year-old boy who simply wanted to see Santa Claus before he died. The boy's family watched on from the hallway as he cried. When I felt the life go from him, I looked up, tears running down my face, and looked over at the window. And that's when the child's mother started screaming, said Mr. Schmidt-Motson. Mr. Schmidt-Motson said he had asked family members to remain outside the room if they were going to break into tears when he arrived for the visit. He also said that I have to be happy, because this is what makes the kids feel great and smile to forget their worries. He went on to say that if you're going to lose it, you have to step outside in the hallway afterwards. I'll stand out in the hall and cry with you, he told the child's family. The Santa doppelganger, who is a mechanical engineer by trade, mind you, is the president of Packing Seals and Engineering in Jacksonboro, Tennessee. He was born on St. Nicholas Day, December 6th, and has played the role professionally for 6 years. His wife, Sharon, she also dresses up as Mrs. Claus. While some Santas have gone 30 or 40 years without ever paying a deathbed visit, Mr. Schmidt-Motson said he has been called upon to do it 4 times now. The little guys and girls have a hard time fathoming the whole concept of death, he explained. But they know Christmas, and they know they have a lot of fun. He, the boy in this latest case, was more concerned about missing Christmas than he was about dying. All he knew is that he didn't feel good. Mr. Schmidt-Motson said he gave the boy a toy from the television show Paw Patrol that his mother had purchased. The boy asked him where he was going after he died, and Schmidt-Motson said he's going to be Santa's number one elf, and he would be welcomed always. The child then sat up and gave his visitor a huge hug and asked one final question. Santa, can you help me? Moments later, he passed away in Mr. Schmidt-Motson's arms. It's tough to relive, he told the BBC. When asked if he would continue to put on the red suit, Mr. Schmidt-Motson said, if someone calls, I'll do it. It hurts, but I'll do it. Now, how about that? In other news, former U.S. Representative Chaka Fetteh was sentenced to a 10-year prison term by a judge who said he was astonished that the veteran legislator would steal government and charity funds to pay for his son's debts and buy a vacation home. Fetteh, a Democrat who was born into a family of black activists in Philadelphia, spent 2 decades in Congress working on housing, education, and gun control abuse and concerns to his district. Fetteh and his TV anchor wife, meanwhile, took a year. Yet Fetteh's finances grew increasingly dire. 2007 run for mayor when he faced new campaign spending limits that led him to take an illegal $1 million loan from a friend. The trouble escalated when the friend called in that debt. Fetteh lost a spring primary just days before trial and resigned his seat following his June conviction. The jury found that he indeed took the $1 million loan from the chairman of Sallie Mae, no less, the Student Loan Corporation. He returned $400,000 of it and with federal grant money he had steered in an education nonprofit run by his former aides. The nonprofit efforts, including a NASA-funded mobile science classroom, emblazoned with Fatah's name that roamed Philadelphia during the mayor campaign, helped promote Fatah's political. However, Fatah was also ordered to repay $600,000 and to NASA. U.S. District Judge Harvey Bartle said, quote, "You have done much good. You have also engaged in grave and widespread criminal activity." Four co-defendants who helped Fatah move government grants and other money between his campaign, the nonprofits, and his consultants will be sentenced throughout the week. Fatah used the money on campaign found. He put $23,000 in towards his son's college loans and took an $18,000 bribe to try to help his friend become an ambassador. Fatah and his wife used that money for a down payment on a Poconos vacation home. They told authorities it covered the friend's purchase of a Porsche owned by Fatah's wife, but the Porsche never left their garage. Fatah had insisted the Department of Justice had been out to get him and his family for years. He plans to appeal that conviction. The congressman's son, however, is serving a 5-year prison term in an overlapping fraud case that went to trial last year. Chaka Chip Fatah Jr. was convicted of using fraudulently obtained business loans to help fund his jet-set lifestyle. The elder Fatah, who earned $100,000 as a congressman, is married to lifelong Philadelphia news anchor Renee Chenault Fatah. They have two school-aged children. Chenault Fatah spent 25 years with WCAU-TV before she resigned after the indictment named her a participant in the bribery scheme. It's important to know that she was never charged and has denied wrongdoing. Fatah's co-defendants include former Philadelphia Deputy Mayor Herbert of Palm Springs, Florida, who had sought an ambassadorship. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison. Two political consultants pleaded guilty and testified at the trial. Prosecutors had asked for a 17 to 21-year sentence, but the judge gave Fatah until January 25th to report to prison. Fatah entered Congress in 1995. Former State Representative Dwight Evans, a fellow Democrat, now holds his seat. In other news, the Cherokee Nation's Attorney General has issued an opinion declaring bans on same-sex marriage to be a violation of their tribal constitution. The move, and a year after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its landmark decision in June 2015, striking down same-sex marriage bans in 13 United States that had still prohibited it. The 12-page opinion, issued and uploaded online by local Tahlequah Daily Press, argues that a 2004 Cherokee law that defined marriage as being explicitly between a man and a woman is unconstitutional. Quote, "The Cherokee National Constitution protects the fundamental right to marry, establish a family, raise children, and enjoy the full protection of the marital laws," quote, M. Todd Hembry wrote in an opinion. He also penned, "The right to marry without the freedom to marry the person of one's choice is no right at all." The sovereign Cherokee Nation is the largest tribal nation in the United States with more than 317,000 citizens. Its capital is Tahlequah, Oklahoma. The ruling will require the tribe to recognize the rights of people who got same-sex marriages in other jurisdictions. The decision arose from a question Nation Tax Commission as to whether it could accept a same-sex marriage certificate as proof of a woman's identity, even though the tribal laws define marriage as, quote, "a civil contract between one man and one woman," unquote. Hembry wrote that prior to the 2004 law, the Cherokee Nation's marriage laws were not gender-specific. He added that there was no evidence that the tribe recognized the same-sex marriage among a minority of its people in its distant history. The tribe's former principal chief, who signed the 2004 law, Chad Smith, told the Tulsa World newspaper that he approved of the opinion. He said he signed the bill in adhering to past Cherokee laws. In the weird news segment, the strange but true, a Breaking Bad-obsessed cannibal who murdered a cop he met on Grindr and dissolved his remains in a bath of acid has been jailed for life. Satanist Stefano Breezy, 50 years old, strangled police officer Gordon Simple after meeting him on a gay cruising application called Grindr. The crystal meth addict copied a storyline from a U.S. crime drama, Breaking Bad, to try to dispose of the corpse in acid. It is being reported that Breezy also boiled and roasted parts of Gordon's body and attempted to eat them with chopsticks at his flat in South Wark, South London, sentencing him to life in prison with a minimum term of 24 years. Judge Nicholas Hilliard, the Record of London, says, You were convicted by a jury of the murder of Gordon Simple. Police were called by neighbors to foul smells coming from the address 6 days after Gordon, 59, from Inverness, and a police officer vanished in April. Breezy, dressed in sunglasses and pink underpants, opened the door to two female officers. They found an acid-filled bath with flesh floating in it and a bucket with Gordon's head inside. Breezy, a former Morgan Stanley merchant banker, computer programmer, told the officers that Satan himself had ordered him to kill. He was brought up a devout Italian Catholic, but thought being homosexual meant he had been spawned by the devil. He later changed his story and said Gordon had accidentally died after a leash around his neck slipped during rough bondage sex. Jurors heard how Gordon liked to starve himself of oxygen during sex and swapped messages with Breezy about masks and gags. The court also heard the pair invited other men on Grindr to join them in a chem sex orgy, but Breezy told the one caller, "We're having a situation here. Someone fell ill, and we're taking care of it, so our party is now canceled." He is believed to have been living a nocturnal lifestyle after quitting his job in the months before the alleged murder. The drug addict is also had a copy of the Satanic Bible downloaded onto his computer, as well as a notebook with handwritten notes to the devil, jurors heard. The jury found him guilty of murder by a majority of 10 to 2 after 30 hours and 46 minutes. Well, an airliner heading from Houston, Texas to Frankfurt, Germany, diverted to John F. Kennedy Airport in New York because of a bomb threat, according to the Port Authority. Someone called in the bomb threat to Lufthansa headquarters. The pilot of the flight made the decision to land at JFK after 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the Port Authority said. The plane was guided to a remote part of the airport. The passengers were offloaded so that the NYPD bomb squad could search the plane. LH-441 was diverted as a matter of precaution in coordination with the relevant authorities and the pilot. The airline tweeted in response to the inquiries. Quote, "Passengers disembark and LH staff will take care of them. The aircraft will be searched by the Port Authority," end quote. In the Middle East today, Saudi police detained a young woman for violating modesty rules after she removed her abaya, the loose-fitting, full-length robes women are required to wear on a main street in the capital of Riyadh. The conservative Muslim country enforces a strict dress code for women in public, bans them from driving entirely, and prohibits the mixing of sexes. The Arabic language Al-Sharq newspaper reported that the woman was detained after a complaint was filed by the religious police. Quote, "Police officers have detained a girl who had removed her abaya on Al-Tahiyya Street implementing a challenge she announced on social media 7 days ago. The newspaper quoted Colonel Fawaz Al-Miyam, a Riyadh police spokesperson, as saying that, quote, that also that the SABQ.org news site said an unnamed woman had posted on Twitter that she would go out in public without her abaya. Both SABQ.org and other news sites, ALWEEAM.com, carried a picture of the woman wearing a black jacket over her ankle-length orange and pink dress. However, SABQ.org concealed the parts exposed of her body. Now, how about that? Don't you dare wear anything that could be deemed offensive. And heaven forbid a woman actually wear a dress in public. Should she be scorned, shunned, arrested, and detained for doing so? Women, there is a war on you, and I'm sorry that so many people have failed to answer the call and find a reasonable way for people of all cultures, beliefs, and countries to live at peace with one another and allow you to wear whatever it is that you want to wear. 2016, rolling into 2017, and women are still being detained for having the audacity to wear ankle-length orange and pink dress. When we return, we're going to talk about preschools. Are they better for your child or are they not? And also, Canada, they are facing a huge opioid epidemic. What can be done? We'll talk about that when we return. You are listening to Radio Pangea. back with Radio Pangea. If you like what you hear, you can always find more at youtube.com/Pangea Foundation. That is P-A-N-G-A-E-A Foundation, youtube.com/Pangea Foundation, or email us, pangeafoundation@gmail.com. Pangea Foundation, all one word, at gmail.com. So moving on to our feature story today, that is preschool really better for your child than not going to preschool? Well, preschool programs aren't cheap, but investing in them could yield returns that stretch far beyond the student's future and impact society, according to a new study. One of the first to examine the economic impact of early childhood education programs well into students' early careers. The study, released from the researchers at the University of Chicago and the University of Southern California, shows that rolling out quality education programs for disadvantaged children can result in high investment returns with around a 13% annual return rate, producing around $6 for every $1 that is spent. That profit comes in the form of parental labor earnings and savings in the healthcare and criminal justice system, components that have not been considered as extensively in past analyses of early childhood education. Such initiatives can cost around $18,000 per student annually, almost $2,000 more than the federal poverty level for a two-person household. But more researchers and politicians are starting to see the payoff of significant initial expense, while a growing coalition has already heralded the benefits of preschool and pushed for a universal early childhood education. This study is one of the first to track students into their 30s, showing how education enriches not only the lives of the students, but also their parents, society, and through monetized returns of investment. Returns on investment in high-quality education have yielded striking results, but it's important to distinguish the difference between the programs in the study and the lower-quality programs that may cut corners to save costs and tend to trap children in disadvantaged families in the cycle of poverty. The study examines two programs in North Carolina that began in the 1970s. Each works with children as young as 8 weeks old through early school age, around five. The nine-hour program serves predominantly low-income African-American children, many of whom had single mothers who had not been able to work or pursue education without such programs. Much of the study's data comes from after the children left full-time care, including 3 years of additional academic support for children ages 5 through 8, and following up when they were 35 years old. The longitudinal data allows researchers to track how the students performed in higher education into adulthood. What they found may not be too surprising for early childhood advocates. Those who had an early engaging education were less likely to commit crimes, more likely to lead healthy lives, and often manage to climb the rungs of the socioeconomic ladder. What may come as a surprise, however, is just how high the financial return on investment for such programs were. Other studies have shown that the number of high-quality pre-K programs nationwide is lacking, but there is an effort to turn that movement around. Many philanthropists are donating to early childhood education efforts as awareness to their benefits grow. Earlier this year, Harvard's Graduate School of Education received $35.5 million to fund research and technologies geared towards such programming. By bringing parents into the schools and involving them in the educational process, the programs were able to showcase the students' successes and help parents stay engaged in their children's education, which had lasting effects and likely contributed to closing some of the gaps between the disadvantaged children and their peers in other circles. There was one caveat to some of the study's findings: the measures used to dictate who qualifies as a disadvantaged student. In 1972, 43% of African-American children were eligible for that program, compared to just 19% in 2014. The decreased trend have changed, with fewer teenagers becoming mothers and more families rising above the poverty line. And that, of in itself, can further show that a pre-K education can help with those life decision-making skills and abilities. Now in Canada, Canada is facing one of the worst opium addiction and opium consumption epidemics in the entire world right now. Facing an ongoing opiate crisis, Canada's Liberal government removed hurdles to opening a new drug consumption room while expanding its fight against narcotic trafficking at the border. The introduction of the legislation paving the way for at least 9 new drug consumption sites across Canada and more custom searches for fentanyl comes after 2,000 overdoses in 2015 and predictions for an even higher number this year. This will reframe problematic substance use as a public health issue that it is, Health Minister Jane Pilpots told a news conference. Evidence shows that supervised consumption sites save lives. Several Canadian cities have looked at opening safe injection sites in recent years, but have been stymied by cumbersome regulations. The government's bill will repeal 26 application criteria set by the previous Tory administration for opening such consumption rooms. High potent and addictive, the analgesic fentanyl is estimated to be up to 100 times stronger than regular morphine. And rated drug carfentanil is 100 times more powerful than fentanyl. 2 milligrams of pure fentanyl, about the size of 4 grains of salt, is enough to kill an average-sized adult, to put it in perspective. Ottawa last month restricted chemicals, 6 chemicals used to make fentanyl, and partnered with China to stem its flow of it into the country. The first North American consumption rooms were established at a clinic in Vancouver in 2003 under special exemption from federal possession and drug trafficking laws. It remains the only facility in North America where addicts can receive medical supervision as they inject heroin legally bought in the streets. Consumption rooms known in Canada as supervised injection sites allow users to inject drugs in a safe and hygienic environment where medical personnel are available and addicts are shielded from police arrest. And with that, you have the news. Thank you for joining us on Radio Pangea. Thank you for all your help. Continue to support us. YouTube.com/Pangea Foundation, PangeaFoundation@gmail.com. I'm Lauren Cartagena, and until we meet again, as always, please think for yourself.